Economic frustrations may be increasing insider threat activity. Brute Retail's badgers have been co-opted by threat actors. DuckTale malware is designated as a full-fledged campaign. And we talk about the reality of risk reduction and mitigation. I'm Calvin Bryan, and this is your Thursday, 28 July edition of Defending the Edge. Well, it wouldn't be another phenomenal show open and a start to your Thursday if I was not here to give you the much anticipated good news that the current economic downturn is likely to, if it has not already, drive an increase in insider threat activities. There was a report this week over on Dark Reading, which was discussing the increased threat potentially posed by employees as the economy continues to stall out, inflation rages, and threat actors seek to take advantage of employees who may need or want a bit of cash. Now, an excerpt from the report over there said that the declining economic conditions could make insiders more susceptible to recruitment offers from threat actors who are looking for allies to assist them in carrying out various attacks. Enterprise security teams need to be aware of the heightened risk and strengthen measures for protecting against, detecting, and responding to insider threats. Now, this was originated in a report by Palo Alto Networks Unit 42, who we've talked about a few times on the show. So what did the Palo Alto report give us? Well, Unit 42 analyzed more than 600 incidences and their response to them between April of 2021 and May of 2022. They found a disturbing trend. Declining economic conditions, as earlier cited, seems to be an increasing contributor or the primary motivating cause in individuals turning to cybercrime or partnering with threat actors. In some cases, mainstream groups such as Lapsus have made direct attempts to pay employees for credentials or entice them with a payout if they'll assist in breaching a network that that employee has access to. According to the Unit 42 report, quote, when some people are struggling to make ends meet, such offers could be more tempting to some, close quote. And it's nothing new in the grand scheme of things to see a threat actor trying to recruit someone to assist in an operation. Intelligence agencies have been doing this for years. I fondly remember the lessons learned in counterintelligence briefings and training events, specifically the degree to which Chinese and Russian intelligence services have historically been very clever at manipulating and turning individuals into assets. Of course, the United States does this too. But what entices individuals to cooperate with a bad actor? Money. Money talks, and in so many cases of espionage, individuals who sign on wittingly in order to cooperate or assist are doing so because they're motivated by a payout. Of course, with ransomware being one of the most prevalent attack types in cybercrime, it should come of no surprise that threat actors are motivated by money. Subsequently, they attempt to use money to allure money to hire on assistance in their activities. Now, continuing the money trend, the top affected industry for cyber attacks so far in 2020 has been finance, with professional and legal services coming close up behind it, and a bit of a tie between manufacturing and healthcare. Now, we've talked about healthcare being a particularly lucrative target for ransomware, and this is due to a proclivity for paying ransoms out in order to restore services or to stop further damage that could potentially have physical ramifications for individuals undergoing care. Think of the hospital getting shut down and many systems that are vital for the survival of individuals being compromised. Now, for the financial sector, it seems pretty cut and dry. We've seen the dramatic rise in attacks on crypto, and this is just in addition to continued attempts to exploit financial institutions, or traditional institutions, rather. Ransomware and insider threats, you name it, the financial sector has pretty big red target on its back, perhaps the front, and maybe even a neon sign over it, and just begging to be hit. Now, if we look at professional legal services, it's much the same reason. These are organizations that have direct or close relationships with clients, and their work is heavily incentivized with a financial gain. You think about legal services where you're talking attorneys or lawyers. These are often very lucrative contracts or service agreements that make them a very enticing target for a threat actor. But what about manufacturing? Well, it only takes a few dot connections to see why the manufacturing sector is a heavy target. If we think about what goes into manufacturing, we're talking about blueprints, schematics, designs, a host of processes, and you could be including the automation that goes into the manufacturing process. Now, in the first part, if you throw in China, you have the world's largest extorter of trade secrets and intellectual property just waiting to jump in and steal those blueprints or the schematics. Perhaps there's an insider threat who recognizes that China and North Korea are willing to pay a hefty sum for some research or for some IP. Now, also, we only need to take a quick glance in history to find many examples of espionage that was conducted by Chinese spies or Americans who turned traitor and sold secrets back to the Communist Party for a cash prize. Now we see this same happening in the cyber domain. Of course, similar to halting the healthcare industry, a manufacturing entity hit by ransomware may also be willing to pay a ransom in order things get back online and continue their work. Now back to the Palo Alto report. Within their investigation, they also laid out the suspected or confirmed means of initial access. Now we've talked about this a lot on the show, so it may not be surprising, but 37% of initial access was via phishing. And close behind that was 31% initial access via software vulnerabilities. For our insider threat concern, we're talking 5%. But let's not get complacent or feel reassured by that number. Out of 600 incidents, that's roughly 30 of them that were perpetrated by an insider threat. Perhaps it's not Vegas odds, but still concerning that 30 incidences were the result of a bad actor inside the organization. Now, what makes it worse when you apply some more context is that the software vulnerabilities and phishing make up 68% of these initial attack vectors, and in large part, they're also able to be mitigated via training or simply keeping software up to date. Now, of course, we can never fully account for zero-day exploits, so there is some play in those numbers. And there's always a little bit of the human factor. Some accidents do happen. But again, especially with the zero days, that's what we have artificial intelligence in our next generation firewalls and our endpoint detection and response. But what do we do about actual insider threats? Well, that could be the golden question that a mature organization is asking themselves as they're working to ensure their security posture is otherwise up to snuff. This brings us back to our earlier talks about zero trust architecture, as well as insider threat monitoring programs, such as the Scion platform from DefendEdge. I've given some examples of zero trust models in the past, such as an employee's credentials being compromised, but thanks to zero trust, they're segmented and their access is sufficiently limited in scope only to what is necessary. And therefore, a breach is contained, or at least it's contained relative to what it could have been. These same principles apply to an insider threat, and even more so, perhaps, when you consider monitoring your employees' activities. Now, I'm not talking about planning bugs and doing surveillance. If you have a zero trust framework in your network, it can quickly become a red flag when an employee starts asking questions about a particular project that they're not cleared access on or that they are attempting to gain information they don't have a need to know for. This type of common sense and skeptic approach to security is one that has been long practiced within the physical security realm. As a detachment commander for a security response within the Marine Embassy Security Group, we were keenly aware of the foot traffic and normal patterns of behaviors within the diplomatic facility. We took interest in individuals who attempted to access places they shouldn't, or they were found loitering near locations that they don't work in. In some ways, this is harder in the digital world, but in other ways, it's easier. We do have credential-based access, which gives us the one-up on storing files somewhere and having access be limited. And as a very simple example, you could look at SharePoint that you have to justify a reason to access a specific page and then wait for approval from the administrator or the security official who has access permissions. But what about the employee who has the clearance? They have the need to know and they should have access to that information or that project. And that employee is the insider threat. Well, this is where best practices, both for device management and insider threat platforms, can come into play. So how does an employee exfiltrate data maliciously? Well, there's multiple ways, but we can talk about the common ones. For example, a USB or external drive is very common, but if your network is configured to block external drives, except in explicit use cases, you've already taken this option off the table. If you have monitoring for your emails, you can see unusual traffic, both source and destination, but also abnormal file types and sizes. And of course, using insider threat detection platforms such as Scion gives you the ability to do some monitoring and correlating via pattern recognition, all powered by machine learning and artificial intelligence. You're able to see traffic within the network that is abnormal. You can analyze employee network behavior before a threat is realized or is taken to its conclusion. Now, I'll leave you with two more statistics that came from Unit 42's investigation research. 50% of successful attacks had a common contributing factor, and that was a lack of multi-factor authentication, or MFA. They also found that 44% of cases lacked an endpoint detection and response solution. So as an analogy, this is the front door being unlocked, or maybe it's locked but not deadbolted, and there was nobody inside the house to see what was happening inside. Now, if this sounds like a concern for your network, you should take a look at our website at www.defendedge.com to see what we can do to help. Now, let's get to this week's headlines. Well, of course, I have more good news for you. Our top story, hacking groups are moving from Cobalt Strike to Brute Retell, according to multiple reports, including one that was done by Unit 42 over at Palo Alto. Many of you are familiar with Cobalt Strike. It's an extremely popular red team tool for penetration testers. Cobalt Strike is a toolkit that allows users to deploy beacons onto compromised devices, and then they can perform remote network surveillance or remote command execution. Well, move over Cobalt Strike. Brute Retell, released in 2020 by Chetanayak, is an ex-Red Team. He's an ex-Red Team member for Mandiant and CrowdStrike. And well, this is on the rise now. Brute Retell is on the rise. It's in the wild and in use by some threat actors. Nayak released Brute Retell as an alternative to Cobalt Strike, and it was done via the Brute Retell Command and Control Center, also known as the BRC4, and it was designed to assess Red Team penetration testing. Similar to Cobalt Strike, it's a simulator tool for adversarial attacks, and it deploys badgers instead of beacons onto the compromised device. Badgers, similarly, they connect back to a C2 node and allow remote commands. Specifically, they allow for receiving execution commands or transmitting the output of previously run commands. Now, the concern is that BRC4 is an elusive and crafty badger, a very crafty badger. It's specifically designed to evade EDR and antivirus detection. In fact, the majority of security software programs were not detecting Brute Retell, and the majority of security vendors that were that are listed on VirusTotal, to which there are many, were not detecting these badgers. So how did this happen? Well, Brute Retell is a licensed software program, and it runs on a one-year license. It requires manual verification of an employee's email and the company affiliation. The use of an instance of Brute Retell is also traceable, then, to the consumer who has the license. According to Chetanayak, the license uncovered by Unit 42 was actually linked back to a disgruntled employee, which is par for the course and on point with the insider threat theme for today. However, it gets worse. To circumvent the authentication required when purchasing the software, threat actors are reportedly creating fake companies, including email accounts, and then they're applying for licenses. So as usual, we have nothing but good news here. I also want to add that if it has not happened already, it is likely that it's only a matter of time before Brute Retell has been exposed to enough threat actors that one or more cracks it open and creates their own version, much like we've seen with Cobalt Strike, and then licenses won't matter. Ideally, what we'll see in short order is some coordination between security vendors and the creator, therefore quickly developing some appropriate definition updates for detecting this software. Oh, and a final note, if you recall back to our reporting on Bumblebee Loader, Brute Retell was used in some of the attacks with Bumblebee Loader as a post-exploitation method. Next up, we have Kimberly White reporting at DefendEdge that July has been a busy month for patching vulnerabilities. Microsoft alone released 84 new updates to address multiple security flaws. These included the zero-day designated under CVE-2022-22049. Now, this attack involved all Windows users and is described as the Windows Client Server Runtime Subsystem, or CSRSS. And this was an elevation of privilege vulnerability, which we've actually talked quite a bit about over the last few weeks. There's been many of these happening. Now, out of 84 updates, 4 of them were considered critical. And besides a plethora of Windows applications that were updated, the patching spree also included Azure, Microsoft Edge, Microsoft Office, Skype, and even Xbox. Another zero day in the wild was involving threat actors exploiting stealing payment information through an open source e-commerce platform known as PrestaShop. This was tagged under CVE-2022-36408. Currently, PrestaShop has thousands of shops that use their site and their infrastructure. This exploit mainly targets older versions of PrestaShop, and these were versions 1.6.0.10 up through versions 1.7 prior to 1.7.8.7. It allows remote attackers to execute arbitrary code, including some unknown vulnerability chains, which were related to SQL injection and MySQL Smarty Cache storage injection. Now, there's no patch for these older versions. However, shops can take measures to protect themselves. As I mentioned, it does not affect the most current version, 1.7.8.7. So again, just update to that if at all possible. If you have some reason why you cannot update that, there's some pressing reason why you can't update to the newest version, what you can do is you can locate the file config, which is /smarty.config.inc.php. So that's inc.php. You can find this under the Press to Shop install, and you can remove lines 4.3 through 4.6. That's 43 to 46 if you're using Press to Shop 1.7, or remove lines 4.0 through 4.3, which is 40 through 43 if you're using Press to Shop 1.6. Now, again, upgrading to the most current version fixes this problem outright, but if you have some reason you can't update, that is your way around it. All right, next up, DuckTail. So DuckTail is a new info stealer malware that has successfully targeted Facebook business and some ad accounts. The campaign behind this is also being called DuckTail after the malware, and it continues the theme of financially driven cybercrime. So according to our partners at WithSecure, quote, the threat actors target individuals and employees that may have access to a Facebook business account with an information stealer malware, close quote. Now, WithSecure's support report says that the malware is designed to steal browser cookies, and it takes advantage of an authenticated Facebook session in order to steal information from their account and ultimately hijack the Facebook business account if that victim has sufficient access to it. Overall, the attack looks something like this. The attacker will start off by identifying the company that they want to exploit, or maybe they find an employee who might have access to a company or the desired company, either or. They trick the employee into downloading a file hosted on Dropbox, Apple iCloud, or Mediafire, and the file contains a malicious payload. Now, this all sounds very familiar to us, but that payload scans the browser. The browser scan steals cookies for an authenticated Facebook session, and it allows the threat actor to steal the personal information of the employee, and subsequently they'll use that session data to evaluate if the employee's account is associated with a business or the ad components. So then the attacker is going to go on. He's going to attempt to exfiltrate information, or if possible, he's going to add his own email to the admin or finance editor roles. Thereby, he's gaining access to the company's Facebook business account, and he can proceed to do exploitation as he likes. WithSecure reports that the targeting pattern for this campaign focuses on the Philippines, India, Saudi Arabia, Italy, Germany, Sweden, and Finland, at least at this time. And it seems to be affiliated with a Vietnamese threat actor. Now, this is dating back to the last half of 2021. The attackers seem to be seeking financial or admin roles specifically so they can access billing and payment. They can get a hold of invoices and other sensitive information that could prove exploitable for their financial gain. All right, let's see. We've also got here the... U.S. State Department has increased rewards for information relating to the North Korean linked to North Korea threat actors. They've increased the reward to $10 million. That's $10 million U.S. dollars. Back in April, the Departments of State and Treasury had issued a joint advisory about rising threat of North Korea-backed cyber threat groups exploiting the global banking and financial institutions. And at that time, the reward was $5 million. So now it's increased to $10 million. And this was for information about their activities, the groups, or their campaigns. Now, that is obviously if the information leads to the location identification of a person who is, quote, acting at the direction or under the control of a foreign government, close quote, and also includes that they are, quote, participants in malicious cyber activity against U.S. critical infrastructure in violation of the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, close quote. And then coincidentally, just days before this reward was increased, North Korea-linked APT-37 was linked to some high-value attacks in the Czech Republic, Poland, and some other areas. APT-37, aka Ricochet Cholima, is using a remote access Trojan known as Coney Rat. Coney Rat was first discovered in 2017 by Talos, who traced it back to approximately 2014, and is still in use today, almost a decade later. APT-37 is using this in a campaign dubbed Stiff Hashtag Bison. I read it as Stiff Bison or Stiff Pound Bison. I'm not sure where they come up with these names. But the campaign is targeting high-value organizations. Now, there's not a lot of information on the campaign yet other than some general ideas of who they're attacking. However, the initial attack vector appears to be a phishing email followed by accessing some kind of archive file that contains the malicious payload. So pretty standard, straightforward, a bit par for the course of what we're used to seeing there. From the report, the attachment used in this campaign is an archive containing a Word document, missile.docx, and a Windows shortcut file, weapons.doc.link.link. That's an LNK file. Once opened, the link file, the infection chain starts. The code execution begins by embedding small bits of code into a shortcut file. Shortcut file runs and executes along with the intended binary whenever the user double-clicks on it. So basically, double-clicking on it, it runs the program. The code executes base64 encoded text, and this is appended to the end of the missile.doc file. So basically, the base64 payload is executed along with a PowerShell script that contains the C2, and downloads and executes both the weapon.doc and some additional files. The weapon.doc is apparently a decoy document, with the other document known as wp.vbs is the actual payload, and it silently runs in the background, creating scheduled tasks on the host called Office Update. So you can see they're pretty clever with this, scheduling tasks that are actually executing PowerShell scripts that are encoded within the original file. And they're hiding it under the name of Office Update, so hopefully you don't see that in your task manager. Now, at this point, the C2 communication, they become established again, and it allows the attackers to access the system. Once the Coney Rat is loaded on the infected system, the threat actors can implement various capabilities, activating various modules, and this includes capturing screenshots, extracting state keys. They can pull off saved credentials, and they can also establish remote command. So once again, very clever remote access Trojan and a campaign that highlights how savvy North Korea threat actors really are. All right, last one for today. I saw an article over at Tripwire by Gary Hibbard. Hibbard is a cybersecurity and data protection specialist with about 35 years in IT. He wrote an article on risk and data breach, specifically his article titled, "Is Any Organization Risk and Data Breach Free?" Now, the short answer there is no, as listeners of our show are well aware, but I think he makes some very interesting points in the article, and I recommend you take a look. He says that during a consulting occasion with a business, he asked what their appetite for risk was, and the CEO responded, "We don't accept any risks. We're risk averse." Now, what's interesting to me is this is the same scenario or issue that I've discussed in cyber and physical security. Everything we do takes on some form of risk. Just before putting together this podcast, I made myself some tea. And as Hubbard points out in his article, ironically enough, everything we do takes risk. And he even mentions making tea, in which there's a risk of burns or spilling your tea. Now, he gives a list of everyday risks, including going on a jog, crossing the road, driving to work. The list could go on, but I think you get the point. Each activity we do has some sort of risk associated with it. The risk could be something new that we've tried, we didn't like it, so it's a very minor risk. Or it could be that we drove to work and we risk somebody T-boning us or a head-on collision on the interstate. Now, Hibbert notes that even starting a business has a risk of failure or grows too quick or other issues. Ironically, the CEO that does not accept any risk took a risk by starting a business. Now, all this to say that risk is inherent in our lives. It's part of the human experience. But we often think of risk as deliberate and exceptionally dangerous or daunting activities that we want to avoid. The reality is that risks are simply a trade-off to daily life, to business, and as I said, it's the human experience. Consciously or unconsciously, we make risk decisions all of our lives, every day. So to the question, can an organization be free from the risk of a data breach? Now, the answer first requires a simpler question. Can an organization be 100% secure against everything at all times? The simple answer is, of course, no. We spoke earlier on the show about 0 days. There are absolutely 0 ways to avoid every single 0 day. You might be vulnerable to a 0 day and get lucky that you weren't the target, and then you find out that there's a patch, you apply it, and you've done so before you become targeted. Or you become the target, and then you are hit by a 0 day. Now, if you have employees, it's possible that at any given time, an employee makes a mistake. They click on the wrong link. They download a malicious file. It's possible that you are one of the 30 in 600 incidents where an insider threat was the catalyst to an attack. Hibbert then goes on to explain that part of the risk management is understanding what an acceptable risk is, what is avoidable, and then taking the appropriate mitigation steps. If a certain risk is entirely avoidable, well, great, you take those steps. However, to my point about insider threats, if your business relies on people, you have a risk that is not going to go away. You can, however, mitigate it with the practices that you put in place. From next-generation firewalls, to EDR, to vulnerability assessments, pen tests, down to employee training and zero-trust architecture, the entire point of risk management is to apply these best practices that will mitigate, if they cannot fully remove, mitigate the risks, minimize them, so that your organization functions optimally with the least chance of a breach, and if a breach does occur, or when it happens, it has the most minimal impact possible. Now, this probably deserves its own segment, so I'll pause it here for now, and we can revisit this in depth another time. We'll turn now to our weekly Threat Intelligence Spotlight. But first, if you are a current DefendEdge client and want to ensure your cybersecurity posture is meeting our best practices, contact your designated DefendEdge specialist or point of contact today. If you are not a current client, head over to our website at www.defendedge.com. That's www.defendedge.com to find out how you can help defend against the multitude of evolving threats. The cyber threats and bad actors are not waiting, and neither should you. Now, let's get to our weekly spotlight. Out of our four nation-state threat actors that we focus on, Iran is perhaps the most secretive and elusive, and though that should not be mistaken for inactivity or inability to action cyber threats, the Iranian regime is well known for their secrecy, and their activities within the cyber domain are no less secretive, at least in most cases. The Israel-Iran cyber war, as it's been called by some analysts, continues to escalate and has now taken an interesting turn in which Iran has begun to publicly, at least more publicly than usual, take credit for some attacks on Israel. It is no secret that Iran and Israel are, in many cases, diametrically opposed, and the Iranian regime has actively sought the production of nuclear weapons to, quote-unquote, level the playing field with its geopolitical adversary, Israel. For their part, Israel maintains that it is purely interested in its security and the protection of its sovereignty. Yet this does not preclude offensive actions taken in the interest of these objectives. As we reported last week, a recent cyber attack on the Iranian steel on an Iranian steel factory turned some heads when, in a rare occurrence, the cyber attack resulted in physical damage, including a fire breaking out. You may also recall that Iran denied the effectiveness of this attack until CCTV footage was leaked by the attackers, and it showed video footage of the attack, including the fire. The nature of the attack led many analysts and Iran to speculate that Israel was behind the attack. Israel's defense secretary ordered an investigation, citing, quote, operational events in a manner that violates Israel's ambiguity posture, ambiguity policy, close quote, which, as far as I can tell, translates something along the lines of, we are investigating why the attack we sanctioned was publicized because we always pretend that we didn't do anything. Now, of course, this was far and away the first cyber attack on Iran. More than a decade ago, the Stuxnet malware was found in the Iranian uranium enrichment centrifuges. They were attempting to disrupt and sabotage the nuclear weapons-grade uranium enrichment. And in recent years, Iran appeared responsible for an attempted breach on Israel's water and sewer system. There was an attack on Iran's Shahid Raji port, and this occurred, I think, in May of 2020. There were some other attacks as well on Iran's Iran's transportation system back in July of 2021. There was also a hack of the Israeli hosting company that leaked a bunch of users' personal information. So the list could kind of go on. But what has experts and analysts curious is the increasing vocality of both Israel and Iran. As mentioned, the statement by the Israeli defense minister is abnormal, but so has Iran's voicing of attacks, or at least the support of attacks they claim are not them, or similar in some gray area. And this seems to have been going on for about 2 years now. Most interestingly, to me at least, Iran claimed responsibility for an attack on the Tel Aviv metro, despite Tel Aviv not having a metro. There's one under construction, but it seems to indicate a desire for making their actions known and their capabilities known. They're claiming credit for something that's not really actualized, but they want to make sure that it's out there. Now, overall, the attacks appear to be getting more sophisticated. For example, the fire that broke out. Now, these do seem to stay quiet initially, and then there's some kind of hint at a resounding success, but also some deniability. It's almost as if the two entities are so used to operating covertly within the shadows that they're not sure how to remain ambiguous with plausible deniability against the growing pressure and the desire to publicize their capabilities. Perhaps this is some sort of posturing and warning tactic that they just really haven't come to terms with. Now, this hypothesis becomes more plausible when you consider the recent comments by then-Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett. Bennett stepped down at the end of last month following the disbanding of the Israeli governing coalition over a disagreement. Subsequently, Foreign Minister Yair Lapid assumed the prime ministership. But let's take a listen to what Bennett had to say regarding cyber attacks on Israel.
If anyone attacks us on cyber, we're going to attack back. We don't go around just wreaking havoc in Tehran. That's never been our policy. Our policy is, though, that if you mess with Israel, you'll pay a price.
While the overt attacks might not be in the news yet, and Iran maintains this quasi-ambiguous status in the shadow war and cyber shadow war with Israel, Israel does the same for that matter, it's only a matter of time until the next attack surfaces. Now, it's a question of whether we will see cyber attacks manifesting with more physical damage. Will either of the two powers become more vocal and adamant about their cyber activities? Only time will tell. That concludes this week's episode. Thank you all for tuning in, and I will see you next week. I'm Calvin Bryant, and this has been Defending the Edge. If you enjoyed the show, be sure to like, subscribe, share with friends and coworkers, and leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you are tuning in from. Defend Edge is your partner in cybersecurity, providing 24/7 cybersecurity monitoring and enhanced proactive threat hunting. We provide security management, advisory services, penetration testing, and more to help you defend the edge of your cyber domain. Find out more at www.defendedge.com. The Defending the Edge podcast is produced and edited by Calvin Bryant. Reporting by the Defend Edge Cyber Threat Intelligence and SOC teams. Marketing by Monica Taylor. Defending the Edge is a Defend Edge production. Copyright Defend Edge 2022.